Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. We are a podcast dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And in thinking seriously, we've endeavored to create an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, cheerful confessionalism. Lots of C words to hopefully, if you're a brand new listener, kind of encourage you to think critically about things, to engage arguments with the utmost vigor and sincerity, but also to do it in the proper mode of discourse, to where we realize that there's always something new to learn from everybody. Even if we think we disagree with everything they say, we can find out that there's lots to learn, even about your own position, that you have some weak spots or whatever. So hopefully the point of this podcast is to open us up to new ideas and to cause us and challenge us and encourage us to think a little bit more carefully, but also kindly towards other people in their positions. So we talked to lots of people and it's lots of fun. And this episode, I'm very excited to talk to Dr. Elizabeth Kincaid about her book, new book, The Law From, or Law From Below, and talking about Francisco Suarez and all sorts of fun stuff. So this is going to be a lot of fun. I'm very excited. And if you haven't seen the book, I love the cover. So I tweeted about it the other day, and even multiple people mentioned how much they like the cover. And I'm like, this is really well done. Even if I had no idea what was in the book, I'd want to pick it up just because it looks cool. So Elizabeth, before we jump in, tell me a little bit about yourself, and then what was the sort of impetus to write this particular book?
Yeah, thanks so much, Jordan. I'm thrilled to be on this podcast and looking forward to this conversation as well. So I am on faculty at Baylor University. I'm the director of the Institute for Faith and Learning here, where work across campus helping faculty and staff integrate faith into their teaching and research. I also am the associate professor of ethics, faith, and culture at Truett Seminary and an affiliate faculty in management at the Handkammer School of Business here at Baylor. In my past life, I'm also an attorney. I practiced law in a couple of different areas before I went back into the academy and went to get a PhD in moral theology and Christian ethics. When I went to start academic work, one of the questions that I was really interested in, because of my previous training and my previous life, and I'm still very interested in, is how do Christians engage with law? How do we think about what laws we should advocate for, how we should respond to laws? I guess probably as a small child, I spent too much time reading Romans 13 and have never stopped asking those questions. And that was what animated me to go into the legal profession to begin with. And I've carried that with me into my academic life as well. So this remains an issue. So why Francisco Suarez? This was completely accidental. I had no intention of going to do work on Suarez when I was applying for PhD work. I was actually very interested in Richard Hooker and his legal theories. I'm Episcopalian, and that was kind of what I'd been hearing about in my world. And this is someone back, you know, early shaping these discussions around law and theology. And so I kind of stumbled across Suarez as I was reading on Hooker and Locke and that English legal tradition. And I'd had some interest in the School of Salamanca, where Suarez was trained at the University of Salamanca, because I knew that this was a group of Christians who'd stood up, particularly the Dominican priests there, robustly to oppose a lot of the Spanish tyrannical conquest in the New World. So that was, it's like, gosh, these seem like morally commendable people interested in this milieu. I'd actually studied in Spain as an undergrad, so had those continuing interest in Spanish and Latin American theology. And I started reading some excerpts from Suarez in a class I took at Notre Dame. And as I was started to think about my dissertation and these questions about how Christians should engage with law, I realized that I wasn't actually that as excited about Hooker. I mean, I'm still like Hooker. I'm not anti-Hooker. But Suarez just had some really interesting theories of law that I hadn't heard before. And most of his work is not translated into English. There's a Spanish critical edition. And so it has the other benefit of being someone that people in this law and theology space haven't spent as much time writing. There's actually been more stuff that's come out since I started engaging in Suarez. It feels like there's kind of a Suarez cottage industry growing up, and it's been fun being part of that emerging discourse. So that's where this idea came from, not at all what I was intending. And that's been really fun and exciting.
That's awesome and fascinating. I'm very much a novice in this area, but it's all super interesting to me. So maybe to start, can you give me just like a broad taxonomy of the big views that are at play with relation to your particular book? So like you mentioned the distinction about laws from above and laws from below, and like just helping to like sort of like fill out the framework.
Where I think Suarez brings a really interesting approach, an approach that's very relevant to us today, is that he is living in a time, late 1500s, early 1600s, where they're really facing the rise of the modern nation state. And they're starting to have a lot of these discussions about, well, what happens when we have a ruler over a big area who can exert a lot more authority through the law than was possible in the medieval period? And so Suarez is engaging with this, for him, very much on the ground reality of this new level of legal authority, but drawing on the Christian tradition, specifically the works of St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, to say, well, like, how do we as Christians respond to this reality? How do we say, look, yeah, of course, like law is important. We need law to have a structured life. We need law to be able to engage with the common good, or to kind of be able to engage the common good. But maybe there are ways that Christians should be thinking about law. And I spend a lot of time, I realize that he's concerned about two different groups of people. He's concerned, actually three different groups of people. He's concerned about at least his reading of Martin Luther, which is people saying, like, laws aren't important for Christians. Christians, kind of pull yourself. He reads Luther as fairly sectarian. I don't know how much he actually was reading Luther, but this is his perception. People who don't think Christians should engage with law at all. Then he has these kind of divine right absolutists, and these are both Catholic and Protestant. He's specifically concerned about James I of England, VI of Scotland, but he's also concerned about Catholic rulers as well, who say, look, we're the ones who make law. We're the ones who determine everything. And then, of course, he's concerned about Machiavelli and this kind of secular, you know, what he considers a possibility of secular tyranny. So he's saying, well, none of these are quite right. None of these are what Christians are called to engage with. So he develops this really interesting structure in which he says, and this is where the idea of law from below comes from, yes, law does depend on a lawgiver. You need someone who's going to promulgate the laws. But that's not the end of the story. What actually happens as laws are promulgated and received is there's a dialectic between the people in a specific community and that ruler. That by the way they receive the laws, the way they interact with laws in their lived context, that's going to change both how laws are applied in that community, and ultimately, if you're a good ruler, how you understand the laws that you're making yourself. So he has this very strong sense of law as activity, law as process. And what I think is interesting for us is we as most Christians in the United States don't think about law that way. We think, gosh, okay, I can pull out of the system, I can protest, I can absent myself, which is, he would say, is kind of a classic Lutheran position. Or, well, I need to be the one in power. The way for me to change law is for my group to get power, and then we're going to impose the right laws. And Suarez has a much more nuanced view of law being worked out. That's much more, I mean, you in your intro, you brought up kind of much more ironic.
Yeah.
And much more involved in listening.
Yeah. So I was very intrigued by this, you know, reading even just the first couple of pages as you're starting to describe this. I'm like, wow, this is interesting to me. I'm not familiar with how this would be cashed out exactly, because it does seem that most people have these very opposing frameworks where you have to do civil disobedience or have a strong man take power. So what does it look like for this concept of law from below, from Suarez to actually, I mean, what does it look like in practice?
Yeah, so I work, this is kind of the second half of my book that I work this out. So he identifies three different practices that he says people can engage in to live out this dialectic. And I mean, you know, he is engaging with the modern nation state. Where I think he's particularly interested and what he's thinking about is kind of local communities. So communities at level of a city, a state. And he says there's three different ways that communities interact with laws. One is through customary practices. So you receive a law is given, and then the community, not like a big plan, but responds to that in a specific way. Another one is interpretation, that people in the community take the law and they say, well, this is what this term means. We all know this and we're going to apply it this way. And the third are practices of equity, where you step outside the law. In a sense, you step outside the law, but not by protesting. You just say, this portion of the law is wrong and we're not going to live it out, but we're going to accept the rest of it. So I have a couple of contemporary examples that I reference from different church communities. And so one of these in the section on interpretation, I talk a lot about the sanctuary movement in the early 80s in these churches. And what was really interesting to me when I dug into it is these churches that were housing people seeking asylum were saying, look, the problem is the way that the word, the federal government has issued this law, and they've said anybody who is a citizen coming from a country where the U.S. has, you know, allies or diplomatic relationships with that government could not be someone seeking asylum on human rights ground, because the United States would not partner with a country where there are human rights violations. And so therefore, and a lot of people were from El Salvador in this instance in the 80s, therefore people from these countries cannot qualify for asylum. And the churches that were involved and the legal scholars were involved in this movement said, well, like, no, like, yes, there are, it is possible the United States would partner with groups, with governments that carry out human rights abuses. And these people may very well be licitly seeking asylum. And so we're going to interpret the law through our actions as saying, yeah, these people are people who could be victims of human rights abuse, and we're going to treat them in this way. Another instance that I reference when I talk about custom is the a group in San Antonio called COPS, which was an organized group that came out of the Roman Catholic Church. It's communities organized for public service. And in the 70s and 80s, they were engaging with a kind of a San Antonio civil government that had very kind of people from the white upper class weren't providing full services to these groups. And so they started as a community, not through protest specifically, but engaging with the lawmakers, setting up these customs of kind of community advocacy, coming together as one community, and they were able to change a lot of the laws.
Yeah, that's
helpful. So it's really interesting to me, I mean, to your point, that the examples that I saw were really churches within communities working to enact these changes. And Suarez, when he's talking about it, a lot of his examples are ecclesial too. I mean, he's obviously working in a different church context in early modern Spain than we have, but he talks a lot. One of the examples he uses is kind of women religious in a convent, and that they can establish customs. And maybe those, not to the point of changing doctrine, but those are going to impact what the bishop in an area is saying, how these women should live together. So he's also does see this ecclesial possibility for this type of interaction.
Yeah. So there's a couple of other interesting sections of your book that I wanted to make sure to spend some time on. One of those was his view of women's role in political life. And if that was significantly different or unique, because I know you mentioned it and I was like, I just don't have the conceptual background to know if he's doing something unique,
yeah,
or if he's sort of like following a progressive line that's already been happening.
So, I mean, I published an article a number of years ago on this, so I hope my recall is good. The book's a little more recent. He's very interesting on this in that he has a very radical view of the possibility for female political authority. And that he says, look, if we believe that men and women are both made in the image of God, and in this sense, they have equal dignity. And this goes back to his kind of basic theory of political authority. So he has this idea that God gives political power to the community then entrusts it to a ruler up to an extent. They can't give away all their power. And he's like, look, so if a community chooses to entrust this power to a ruler, there's no reason that women, equally made in the image of God, cannot exercise this power as well as men. He's, you know, says kind of the normal throat clearing things like, but we know that women may not have the education or may be more weak minded. But he even says a woman, he's like, he references a scripture text about women being subordinate to men. And he says, this is only in the context of marriage. This is not intended to be in the context of a civil government, because that's not a sacramental relationship in the same way. So he said, for example, a female ruler would exercise political authority over her own husband. He might exercise some type of familial authority over her, but when she's acting as a queen, he is subordinate to her, which is a pretty strong statement. And where I don't think this is totally unique, but it is definitely a stronger statement than we see in most places. And I think where this is coming from is Isabel of Castile, Isabella la Católica, the Isabella, Ferdinand and Isabella. And in Spain, she was, had her own sovereign authority separate from her husband and was seen as this somewhat saintly figure, widely revered. There's a lot of references tying her to the Virgin Mary. He grows up in this culture. And the Habsburg royal family had this tradition of, like, women could inherit, or sending aunts or sisters who aren't having kids off to be governors of the different Habsburg territories, so the Low Country, Belgium. So there's a tradition in practice that he sees, and he has a lot of respect, or one, the assumption is he has a lot of respect for these women. And so he's saying, this is like, there's nothing here contrary to scripture. So it's just, I'm not an expert in political thought of kind of early modern Spain, but as I was researching around this, like, it doesn't run against the tide, but it is very strong. And particularly the point about, like, the woman's husband is subordinate to her politically.
Yeah, that's super
interesting.
And
the way he's parsing the scriptures.
I find all this stuff fascinating. So another piece that I'm really interested in is, you explained at points Suarez's insights with reference to Augustine and Thomas in particular. I'd be interested to see how you can explain how he's drawing on these, how he's making use of them, where he's differing. Is he leaning more one direction or the other? Not that, they're completely opposites or something, but just as touchstones.
So what I realized eventually is that his whole framing for his discussion on law is Augustine's City of God. And he takes very seriously Augustine's statement in Book 19 that there are certain goods that the earthly city and the heavenly city hold in common, that both need and that they can work together to achieve. And these are goods of justice and peace. And so he is very convinced that civil laws governing the achievement of these natural goods have moral validity and significance. And I think he's extrapolating this from Augustine. He goes back and talks some about Genesis, and he says, look, even if Adam and Eve hadn't fallen, they would still have needed laws eventually. They would have needed laws to help govern and regulate as they had more kids and civilization grew. So he's reading Augustine, taking Augustine, reading Genesis through that lens to argue for this very positive view of civil laws that are aimed at the natural good. And then what he does is he takes Thomas's articulation of the relationship between civil and natural law, the limits of civil law. And whereas for Thomas, this is about five questions, he built it out into seven volumes. And there's a lot of dissension in Suarez scholarship about how closely he follows Thomas. Like, is he a voluntarist? Because he does say more strongly than Thomas, yes, law begins in the will of the ruler. I fall on the side of saying he is not rejecting Thomas at all. He is developing Thomas in his discussion about kind of the law between, and then it goes on to say, well, yeah, but it's also has to be governed according to prudence and the common good, that because he's engaging specifically with these theories of royal absolutism, that he's leaning more on the will voluntarist discussion because that's the context he's engaging in. And he's not, the other key with Suarez is he's a Jesuit. And for Jesuits, the assumption is that Aquinas is the theologian, and you can see this in the constitutions and the ratio of the Society of Jesus. Aquinas is the theologian, but you don't have to receive everything about him. So this is how, for example, Jesuits end up disagreeing with Aquinas on the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. But so he has sort of this, like, Aquinas is his inspiration. He's giving him all the ideas about what justice is, what the natural law is, but, like, he doesn't treat Aquinas like his textbook. He's taking Aquinas and applying him to the contemporary world that he's living in at that point.
Yeah, very helpful. So you mentioned Richard Hooker earlier on and John Locke. I would be interested to see in what ways does Suarez end up differing from them in I mean, I don't know. You can go in big detail or small detail.
Yeah. So I think from a key, I mean, one differing from Hooker, Hooker is operating in the Church of England. And so he is trying to justify this idea of the king being the head of the church. And, like, what does that mean? So he and Suarez are going to have a lot of similarities around ideas of custom, people's engagement with law. But Suarez is very clear that there is a clear distinction between civil authority and sacred authority. And Hooker is not going to have that distinction. Where I think he differs from Locke, and there's also a lot that you can see in Locke that is similar to Suarez, is he's much less, I mean, this is stereotypical, that's what everybody says, he's much less individualistic. He does have this strong view of the importance of the individual, but his idea, it's not just a social contract. It's a sacramental social contract. And so the reason that the community coming together can entrust some of their power to the leader is because God is doing something. God is, he actually refers to it as the sacramentum mysticum, you know, a mystical sacrament. It's because God made humans in a certain way that when we come together in a perfect community, that we kind of generate this authority that then can be passed with limits to a ruler, never passed totally and never passed in a way that runs against God's will. So it's a much, I talk in the book a lot, like, this is political theology. It's a much more robust theological understanding than Locke, which does cash out in much more focus on the community.
So is there a sense in which, I mean, in our contemporary context, people are going to be drawn naturally more to Locke than Suarez because of that?
Oh, I think absolutely. Yeah. And I think we all think like Locke. I mean, we are all, I think you can get a lot out of Suarez if you're not a Christian. I think a lot of these sort of practical understandings about law, I draw a lot of connections between Suarez and Lon Fuller, who is a legal philosopher. But I think this kind of key mystical sacrament, the community coming together, like, yeah, that's going to be more appealing to Christians. But I do think we are all so conditioned to think about our own individual action in the political sphere, as opposed to thinking communally, that it's hard for any of us to kind of go back to this more, and he's not communitarian, but a more communal approach to thinking about laws, because we're so shaped by the world we live in.
Yeah. So one figure you bring up in the book at one point is Carl Schmitt and his view of government. And it seems like in our contemporary context, with the growth of so-called Christian nationalism, and now when I use that term, I don't just mean the generic sense of you're a Christian and you're a nationalist, but like an actual identity where you want to sort of almost meld the civil and the mm-hmm. and the sacred, for lack of a better term, together in some way. So older, you know, 16th, 17th century sort of Protestant visions of the civil magistrate functioning. And so maybe they are able to settle matters of church discipline or whatever else it may be. Maybe it's not like completely mm-hmm. universal. There could be limits within it. But like, is there in a sense in this current context, I mean, it seems like we're searching for resources. Why is it people are gravitating to people like Schmitt rather than finding resources like Suarez or others as amendable to their projects?
Yeah. I think this is going to be some broad cultural critique. I think we all, kind of across the political spectrum, live in a world in which we are very interested in thinking about power as the solution to our problems. So if the right we can get power, then all we need to do is legislate from the top down and enforce to fix that power. This is why the sort of strong man figure is appealing to many of us, because I think we have a sense that we live in a world that's very broken. We do live in a world where sort of these technological forces beyond our control that are very powerful are very terrifying. And Suarez is not, I mean, Schmitt offers that, you know, Schmitt has the idea that like, it's the ruler who decides the exception when the ruler can go beyond the law. I mean, it is power straight down. It's Thomas Hobbes straight down. Kind of the Leviathan. So yeah, I think it's very easy to say, well, gosh, let's get the quick, easy fix, get the right person in power, and then we can legislate our problems away. And Suarez would be exceptionally wary of that. And he is a man of his time. And he definitely has this sense, for example, that like, could the church delegate power to the state to enforce certain like restrictions over the baptized? Yes, he has that concept. But what he is particularly interested in is like, he does not want to say that there is anything in civil authority as received from God, as in this theological context that he's operating in, that like gives secular rulers the insights or the capacities to enforce spiritual things. He actually is very opposed to that. He's like, the way that we can discern spiritual goods is through the gift of the Holy Spirit, through the infused virtues. And so why on earth would you want to give this power to some secular ruler who, you know, history demonstrates probably does not possess in fullness the gifts of the Holy Spirit? So he's very interested in saying things like, well, how could a ruler incentivize or encourage people to make choices in line with the gospel? But he's deeply worried about people imposing this type of power related to spiritual goods from the top down, because he thinks that is a dramatic theological failure and overreach in our understanding of civic power.
Yeah. So this is interesting, thinking about the concept of power, because it seems like in my mind, power is not absolutely a bad thing, but it always does seem to corrupt, as the saying goes. Mm-hmm. So in what sense can we appropriately allow for the usage of power for the good, the sake of the good,
right,
without it becoming this all-encompassing, destroying thing?
Yeah. So, I mean, he thinks that you have to have power too, right? Like you have to have an executive, and someone who is an executive who is capable of enforcing the laws. But his views on this are going to be relatively minimalist. And this is where we go back to Augustine. Like, you're trying to enforce laws that promote basic peace and justice. And that's what the city of man is capable of achieving in a very limited sense. And I think this is where this idea of kind of law as dialectic is really important to him, that the virtuous ruler is going to take a stab at this through laws and will enforce the laws. I mean, that he is absolutely like, this is where the will of the ruler comes in, but the virtuous ruler will be attuned and sensitive to how this law is being received, how it fits in a specific community. And so the power itself is not the end of the day. And the reason he thinks this is he says, this grant of power, a political power, goes to the people and they cannot fully alienate it. The group of the people can never give the ruler the totality of their power.
Yeah. So one other thing I wanted to make sure to touch on was the power of custom and how that's used in his framework. So maybe you could expand on that a little bit.
Yeah. So this goes back to this basic idea, right? Like, okay, so the community comes together, they receive this power, this grant of kind of sovereign power from God. This is something that's very important. Like, this is a survives the fall. This is one of God's kind of provisions for us. I mean, in reform terms, it'd be an example of common grace. That's not a term he's going to use. And so when the people give the power, to entrust the power to the ruler for better administration of it, because they always retain a residue, they can always shape and form the ruler's laws. And his primary idea is this idea of custom, that it's the way that the people receive the laws, the way they live out the laws in their specific community, that kind of have the final say, the final shaping of the law. And it is a foolish ruler who does not receive that custom and then adjust the law to fix it in the way that it's been applied. And there's a lot of similarities here between with the Anglo-American system of the common law. This sense of like popular engagement shaping the law.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, you know, as you've done this work and given your own personal experience in the legal field, twofold question. Number one, do you think there's a lot of value in people who are more in the, I don't know, practical side of these professions to say, study history to understand these different things? And then number two, are there other figures that should be mined for resources that haven't been, or that just aren't getting the sort of popularity, so to speak, that they should be getting?
Yeah. I would say one, absolutely. This is one of the things I'm really interested in is education in professional schools, particularly for Christians. I mean, you brought up Christian nationalism. Obviously, I am not a fan of Christian nationalism, nor do I think Suarez would be. Part of the problems with discourse like that is that it is easier to fall into what I think are some theological traps if you don't know history, if you don't know the way that the churches tradition and discourse around this has developed, which doesn't mean that I'm very happy that I left legal practice to go off and be a specialist. I don't think that's God's call for everyone by any means. And I think it's a big problem if we all were academics. But I do think that thinking theologically about law and about power and understanding, and I mean, all of these theologians are responding to temptations. Like, they're responding to real questions that came up. And so if we know those temptations, we're better fit to say, hey, well, what Suarez is doing, he's engaged in this retrieval process. Let's take what Aquinas said 300 years before, and let's try to figure out how this applies in his specific political context. And then, 400 years later, that's what I was trying to do with his work and my own work. So I think that the more we're trained and understand this tradition, the less likely we are to be kind of seduced by some new idea that comes along, and able to relativize our own cultural context to say this isn't what Christians have always thought. So your second question is, who are other people who are very important? I talked about the school of Salamanca at the beginning. And one of the things that's really interesting to me in the school of Salamanca is through this group of these Dominican, primarily Dominican at the beginning, professors who are engaged in their own retrieval of Thomas Aquinas from their studies at the University of Paris, and they bring them back to Spain. And when you're reading their works, folks like Vitoria and Soto, you see how overwhelming the cultural change that came from the European discovery of the New World was. Like, this was a seismic shift. And I'm getting this from other people, but all these theological questions at that time are responding to the Reformation and responding to this discovery of the New World. And people are really struggling. They're really thrown off balance. They're having to learn how to do this creative retrieval of the tradition to face these very significant moral challenges. So when you read someone like Vitoria and his discussion about the Spanish conquest in the New World, or Soto on justice, it's really a, not only do I think they have a lot of great insights, De las Casas would be another one. I'm doing a little work around De las Casas with some colleagues at Baylor right now. They don't get it all right. But watching how they struggle and engage with new cultural, political questions is a great example for us as we deal with these new challenges in our own time.
Very helpful. So this naturally leads me to, I want to spend a little bit of time learning a little bit about the institute that you are based out of there at Baylor. I'd love to just understand, what is it all that you guys do? Is it just for Baylor? Is it for other universities or other contexts? Do you have plans to do more than just Baylor? Like, those sort of things. I'm interested.
So I'm very new. I just started 3 months ago. And the Institute of Faith and Learning was established in 1999 at Baylor. And this was at a time when Baylor was really in a phase of examination and growth and aiming at becoming an R1 research university, which they became a couple of years ago, aiming at having a big athletic presence, but also really committing to saying that Baylor was going to remain a Christian school with a Baptist heritage. And which is a very, you know, when you look at kind of the history, particularly of Protestant schools in this country, it has been very challenging to hang on to that Christian heritage in a robust way. So the Institute was started then. It's in the provost office, and our mandate is really to work with faculty across campus and staff, and to help them think about their vocation as Christian academics, about how scripture and theology can inform their research and their teaching, and to really be a resource. I mean, I think the people who set this up were very right that the key to maintaining this robust Christian identity is that you have faculty and staff who are formed to understand why this is important, that it can't just be sort of a listserv as check the box, but that it needs to be invigorating across the campus. So we run a fair amount of programming for faculty. We have a cohort for new faculty. We run a retreat that gives faculty space to build community and reflect on their vocation as Christian faculty. We're speaking of challenges of the time, we're partnering with some folks next year to sponsor a faculty interdisciplinary research group on AI and ethics. Institute's been going 25 years. So there's a real robust heritage, and we're thinking about how do we expand to different parts of the university. As far as folks outside Baylor, if people are interested in these discussions, they can always subscribe to our newsletter where we have discussions. We kind of highlight what's going on at Baylor, hopefully some ideas for people at other institutions. We also host a symposium every year. The call will go out on our social media and our newsletter. Last year we had about over 500 folks. It's people from universities, we had nonprofit institutions, churches, and it's a space for interdisciplinary reflection on theological responses to contemporary issues in the space of community. So it is an academic conference, but there also are elements of, you know, we spend a lot of time eating meals together, being in a community. So in the past, the symposium has been in October. We're actually next year moving it to February 2026, so we don't compete with football. And our theme for next year is going to be technology and the human person in the age of AI. So we would welcome, you know, people listening to this podcast, I think would be the right people who would enjoy this, you know, welcome non-academic attendees, academic attendees, paper proposals, paper panels. So that's really part of our hope with this program, to add to the discourse kind of across in a rigorous, robust way. I mean, what you're doing at this podcast, across the church.
Very cool. AI is continuing to be a major issue and challenge. Mm-hmm. So I will be very interested to see the proceedings from that. I know you've got a lot going on with being the director of the center, as well as being on faculty. Are you teaching any classes regularly? Are you supervising students?
Am supervising students. I'm sitting on committees and stuff like that. I'm teaching. I didn't teach this fall. I'm actually really looking forward to this. My last job actually was in a business school. I had a chair in business ethics, even though I'm a theologian. And so I'm going to be teaching a course at Truett on ethics and leadership in church and nonprofit management, and really providing both some practical business skills, like how do you talk to your lawyer, and some theological grounding for our students to really reflect about why is it important to be a good business leader, not just a spiritual leader for people who are running churches. My hope is I also would love to eventually teach some religion and law classes. I want to stay involved in this world as well, and that world as well. So I'm teaching that, supervising, sitting on some committees, and my job is 50% administrative, and then the rest of it is being a normal faculty member, which is a really fun combination.
Now, if people are interested in connecting with you, learning more about what you're doing, is there an easy place for them to go to do that?
Yeah, I have a website that I think is Elizabeth Rain Kincaid. They can email me at my Baylor email. They can go to the IFA Institute for Faith and Learning website for Baylor. My email's there. They can sign up for our newsletter there. They can follow me or the Institute on social media.
Awesome. Very cool.
Yeah. Despite my concerns about AI, we've also gone all in on social media and the Institute. So we are compromising, just like Suarez, we're compromising with the culture in our own way.
That's great. Well, thanks for taking the time to talk with us. So reminder, if you've been listening, the book that we've been discussing, I will have a link to it in the show notes. So if you're listening to it on your phone or wherever it may be, you just click the little link. It'll be hyperlinked and it'll take you directly over. I put it on Amazon, but you can buy it from wherever store you buy it from. That's just the most common one. And so it's just easy for me to drop those links in there. And you can support people like Elizabeth and the work that they're doing there to provide more resources for us. This book, I don't remember if it's a $100 book or not. Is this? No, it's not. So that's even more reason to buy it.
I think it's $35 or $40.
Okay. See, that's to me, that's an appropriate price for an academic book. So go out, purchase it, support Elizabeth, support presses like it's Georgetown, right?
Georgetown.
Yeah, so I think they did a fabulous job on it. A lot of university presses don't have, you know, it's like, let's find the most 1970s font and cover that we can.
So I will say, actually, the cover is the front piece from one of Suarez's books. They pulled it. So it's not 1970s, it's 1610s. That's so awesome. They pulled the front piece and inserted my title in the middle. So there's a little picture of him at the bottom. And then the some key figures who he found really influential in his work. And
very cool.
Outside. Yeah, so that's where it came from.
Well, thanks again for the time. And everybody who's been listening, thanks for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you all soon.
Climbing Mount McKinley, so to entertain myself, I go to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, I can play hundreds of online casino-style games for free, like online slots, bingo, slingo, and more. Plus, I get a daily login bonus. It's just too bad that up here, I don't have anyone to share my excitement with. Woohoo! Woohoo!
Chumba. Live the Chumba life anytime, anywhere. Play for free now at ChumbaCasino.com. VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Need parts now? O'ReillyAuto.com offers in-store pickup, same-day home delivery, or next-day home shipping. Get more parts your way at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.